the Paul Harris Show on the Big 550 KTRS Friday afternoons. Thank you very much for listening. Tim and Max are both here with me. Later on, the Harris Challenge and Knuckleheads in the News. Yep. And, of course, you can email me anytime, paul@harrisonline.com. Or you can write to me on Facebook and follow me on Twitter, at Paul Harris Show. This is the hour each week where Max and I talk about new movies. We did not get a chance to do this last week because we were both off on Thanksgiving and Friday. Didn't have a chance to talk about several movies that have opened in our area. And several movies that, by the way, I think are going to be around in the theaters for several weeks as well. And probably a few of these that we're going to talk about today that you may not have seen yet will probably end up near the top of the best movies of the year list. So we're talking about some good stuff here. And the first one we're going to talk about is called Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri.
Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri is the latest film from writer, director, and playwright Martin McDonough, who wrote the play The Pillow Man, which is a very divisive play. And he also wrote and directed one of the best comedies in recent times. If you've not seen this movie, please put it on your queue. I'm talking about In Bruges with Colin Farrell. And it's just a fantastic, fantastic movie. He followed that up with Seven Psychopaths, starring Christopher Walken, which I think he thought might have broke him in America. Like, oh, look, it's this crazy, wacky comedy. Didn't really go anywhere, didn't do anything, was not as successful with critics or fans as In Bruges.
And was not a good movie.
Well, there's that.
Yeah.
And now he returns with something that's slightly different from those first two films. I mean, he likes to investigate darker things in his playwright work and then go more for comedy in his movies. Well, with Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, I kept hearing it compared to Fargo. And not just because it stars Frances McDormand. I realized after watching the movie why a lot of people are comparing it to Fargo, and that's because of the tone of the film. Normally, when you call out a film's inconsistent tone or juggling of different tones, it is a demerit. You're saying something bad about it. But what the Coen brothers were able to do with Fargo is something quite extraordinary. They had what I consider a black comedy with some streaks of really great drama. You think about William H. Macy tearing out your heart with what happens to him and how horrifying it was, but also you're able to put somebody in a wood chipper and have it be funny. And of course, nobody was expecting a movie like that from the Coens at that time, and it ended up winning them Best Picture. Many years later, Martin McDonough, I think, is trying to do the inverse of that. I think that he's made a drama with some streaks of comedy, so sort of the opposite of Fargo. Ebbing, Missouri, to the best of my knowledge, is not a place that actually exists, but I do think that this, for an Irish writer, does kind of nail the small town aspect of some of the outlying areas of Missouri. Missouri, if you will, although nobody in the film says Missouri, which I think was a missed opportunity.
That's because they know it's correctly pronounced Missouri.
Well, I'm just for these characters.
I know.
Now, Frances McDormand is phenomenal in this film. As a matter of fact, without showing my hand a little too early, I think she's better than the film itself. She plays this role completely straight. She is the devastated mother of a murdered daughter who wants justice, and she doesn't think that Chief Willoughby in the small town is doing enough. Chief Willoughby is played by Woody Harrelson, who's had sort of a hit and miss year. You know, he was LBJ. Nobody really liked that movie very much. He was also the father in Glass Castle. I thought he was great in that movie. Here, he's really not in the film a lot, so he doesn't really make that big of an impression, I don't think. But Frances McDormand is fantastic. I think she'll be nominated for Best Actress for this movie. I only wish I liked the rest of the movie more. When you get into Sam Rockwell, who's always consistently great in everything he's done, he's playing a character which kind of reminded me of this documentary show, this reality show, if you will, called Small Town Security. And I wouldn't be surprised if it comes out later that he based some of his role on those actual people. But he's playing, I imagine, a slightly mentally challenged deputy, and I don't understand if this role is played for laughs, if you're supposed to be poking fun at him, but it completely took me out of the movie, not because he's not good in the role, but because it seemed too cartoony for a film that was trying to deal with this serious subject. And that's my problem with Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. It feels too hyper-realistic. These don't feel like real people. They don't feel like authentic people. It feels too high concept for me, except for Frances McDormand, who's playing it like a real grieving mother.
I disagree. I like this movie a lot. And we should say that the three billboards, we should explain what that is. She, as the grieving mother whose daughter had died a horrible death 9 months earlier, was upset that the cops weren't doing anything anymore because they had run out of leads. And so she bought the space on these three billboards that were empty and not being used in a kind of dilapidated condition, and put up signs urging the sheriff to do more by essentially embarrassing him.
Yes.
By reminding people of the case. And the sheriff and officer Jason Dixon, played by Sam Rockwell, try to get her to take the billboards down, but she refuses, and the battle is on. Now, that's all the plot I would ever tell you about this movie, because everything else is so wonderful as it moves forward. And it does have the same tone as Fargo and other great work by the Coen brothers and other people. And Frances McDormand is fantastic as Mildred, the deeply grieving mother. She's worn down by life. She's worn down by death. And she's really good. But I disagree with you, Max. I think Woody Harrelson and Sam Rockwell match her step by step, and it's some of the best work that they've ever done. There's also wonderful support work in here by Abby Cornish and Peter Dinklage and Caleb Landry Jones.
Yes.
And John Hawkes, who was so good in the movie that made Jennifer Lawrence a star, right. Winter's Bone.
He's great.
And I will always botch this guy's name, Zelcho Ivanek. I never can pronounce his name, but I always love seeing him on screen. He's good in a very small role. But to me, what makes Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri unique is the way the characters change. Just when you think you've learned who this one is and how he or she will act, they do the opposite. And it's that unpredictability that is so true to life, and it drives the story, and it keeps us on our toes. And this Martin McDonagh, who not only wrote but also directed and produced this movie, he's got a terrific eye and ear for the way real people in small towns speak to each other. I think he treads the thin line between tragedy and comedy very, very well. And I know you didn't like it, but I think he's going to get nominated for an Oscar for Best Original Screenplay.
I just don't see that happening.
I give this movie a 9.5 out of 10 because I can barely find anything that I did not like about it.
Oof, boy, I give Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri a 6, and 5 of those points are all for Frances McDormand.
Okay, that's fair enough. I just think that, and by the way, I've told several of my friends to go see it, and they went to see it, and they told me they were disappointed in the ending, which we're not going to give away here at all.
Oh, I'm not at all.
I'll just leave it this way. I would like to see Four Billboards Outside of Ebbing, Missouri next.
The ending is actually, without saying anything about it, one of my favorite parts of the film. I thought it ended spectacularly.
Me too. But some people have come back to me and said they were unsatisfied with that, and I understand why.
I do too.
Okay. Yeah. All right, so let's leave that alone. Next, let's talk about Coco, which is a new movie from Pixar, a company that has produced some eye-popping advancements in animation over the years. I can still remember the first time I saw Sully's fur in Monsters, Inc. and going, wow!
Absolutely.
Or the water effects in Finding Nemo, or the memory balls in Inside Out. Mm-hmm. All brilliant and beautiful on screen. And now, with Coco, Pixar has found a whole new palette of colors to play with on the screen. Coco is the story of Miguel, a Mexican boy who loves music, but is forbidden to play or sing any songs by his family because a few generations back, his great-great-grandfather abandoned his wife and daughter to pursue a career as a singer-songwriter. But Miguel still idolizes that guy, whose name is Ernesto de la Cruz, who's voiced by Benjamin Bratt, and he looks at him as his legendary, although dead, crooner, and he wants to be like him, so much so that he steals De La Cruz's guitar out of his mausoleum in the center of the town because Miguel wants to perform with it at the talent show in the town square on Dia de Muertos, which is a Mexican holiday. It's the Day of the Dead. When Miguel strums De La Cruz's guitar, he is transported to the land of the dead, and that's where the adventure takes off and the colors really come alive. It's there that Miguel meets some of his deceased relatives and other characters as he tries to find De La Cruz so he can get his blessing to become a musician like his idol. But things don't go exactly as he planned them. He needs the assistance of a goofy-looking character named Hector, who's voiced by Gael Garcia Bernal. He claims to know De La Cruz very well, and he's going to help Miguel, but only if Miguel will take Hector's picture back to the land of the living so his daughter will remember him. And that's really the theme of this movie. Remembering your ancestors. Remembering your family. Because in the movie, if you're forgotten by your descendants, you turn into dust and you drift away forever, very much like relatives that we all might have known from a couple of generations ago, but we never think about them, and essentially they've turned into drift. Now that's the nice message of Coco, which in addition to its vividly created world also has several songs in it, and there's the theme song in the movie is Remember Me, which is sung by several different characters as the story unfolds. It is not as memorable as Let It Go, the movie from Frozen. And by the way, when you go see this, you're going to sit through a 21-minute Pixar short about Olaf from Frozen.
And this has angered a whole lot of people. As a matter of fact, I'm pretty sure in different theaters in Mexico, they have dropped that completely because the audiences who wanted to go see Coco don't care about Frozen.
And don't want to sit through a 21-minute short. Pixar in the past has made shorts that ran maybe 6 or 7 minutes.
Well,
21 minutes is too long.
The behind-the-scenes info on this was going to be a television special. Olaf's a Christmas special for TV. That's mm-hmm. why it's 21 minutes. Mm-hmm. They were going to allow
Perfect.
For commercials.
Yeah.
Right. And then at the last minute, they said, you know what? No, we'll put this in front of Coco.
Big mistake.
It was a big mistake.
And here's why it's an additional mistake. And you and I have talked about this. You go see a movie now. You pay your good money up front. You go to the concession stand. You sit down in that theater for a 7 o'clock at night show. You got to sit through 20 minutes of the pre-show trailers and commercials.
20 minutes of trailers, yeah, exactly.
And then you got to sit through a 21-minute short. The movie you wanted to see at 7 o'clock isn't going to start until 7:41? No. Especially if you're going to see a family movie, which means you have kids there.
Yeah.
You're making the night so much longer. So the movie does have this wonderful sentimental side to it, and I do think the movie is wrapped up a little bit too easily for my taste, but it still tugged at my heartstrings. I think it'll tug at yours as well. This movie opened to record-breaking numbers in Mexico and was number one in the United States over Thanksgiving weekend. I find it ironic that at a time when we have a president who's created antipathy for pretty much everyone from south of the border, here's a movie that takes place south of the border, and it's a hit. And by the way, the Mexican community in this country is really coming out for this thing. They're not the only ones seeing it. Plenty of people of all sorts of skin colors and all sorts of ethnic heritages are going to see this movie, and they're liking it. It is good for me to see Pixar back on the winning track and not falling into the sequelitis curse of Cars 3 and Finding Dory and over and over and over again. It's nice to see them telling an original story, and a good one, while also pushing the technical side.
When some parents have heard that this is set around the Day of the Dead, they're worried about the afterlife, they're worried about scary things.
There's nothing
scary
in this
movie. At all for young kids?
You know what? It's scary, but in the way that you see scary stuff in a family movie.
But it is addressing death. It is addressing mortality. It might be one of the first times a young kid is seeing a film that is about dying. You might want to talk to your kids about that.
Okay. Remember Toy Story 3? All the toys are in that place where they're about to go into this inferno inside mm-hmm. this incinerator compactor.
Mm-hmm.
That was scarier than anything you're going to see in Coco. And I think that Coco has got a wonderful message to it. The only thing that might be scary is that notion of your ancestors who you've forgotten turning to dust and drifting away. But that's a good message to young kids. Remember grandpa and great grandpa and great grandma and your aunts and uncles and all that sort of stuff. I give it an 8 out of 10.
Nice.
Coco. I liked it a lot. We'll take a break and come back with more of the Showbiz Show here on the Big 550 KTRS right after this. It's the Big 550 KTRS. I am Paul Harris. Thanks so much for listening. We're talking about movies as we do every week in this hour, and we've already talked about Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, which I gave a 9.5 and Max gave a 6. And we talked about Coco, the new Pixar movie, which I gave an 8 and Max hasn't seen yet. And so let's go to another movie that you've seen, but I haven't, from Greta Gerwig called Lady Bird.
That's right.
This looks like one of those movies that I'm going to have to take my wife to, but I don't want it to be I have to take it to her. Mm-hmm. I want to take it to her.
Sure.
Which is it going to be? Let's Let's find out.
This is the directorial debut from Greta Gerwig, who is sort of the independent scene hit era it girl in the tradition of, you know, Gretchen Mol or Zooey Deschanel. She's been great in smaller movies over the years, like House of the Devil and Mistress America, and she was in 20th Century Women last year, which was on my top 10 list, and she was phenomenal in that movie. She was my pick for Best Supporting Actress last year. Some of those films that I mentioned, like Mistress America and Frances Ha, were co-written and directed by Noah Baumbach, who did Squid and the Whale. He's worked with Wes Anderson. They have a professional relationship for a couple of years now, and a personal one as well. And so with this movie, even though it's her directorial debut, because she co-wrote Mistress America and Frances Ha, this feels like her third movie. It's very much in the same vein as those movies. I think it's better than those movies. However, this movie is called Lady Bird, and so everybody thinks it's about Lady Bird Johnson.
You know, I started hearing about this at the same time we started hearing about Woody Harrelson in the Rob Reiner movie LBJ, and I thought, wow, that's weird that those two are coming out around the same time.
Except it has nothing to do with Lady Bird Johnson. It also has nothing to do with Hank Hill's dog on King of the Hill, which was named Lady Bird.
Okay.
It has nothing to do with either of those things. It is a nickname that this character has, which makes sense in the context of the movie. And it makes more sense, I think, from a marketing standpoint, too, cynically speaking. If you call the movie Bluebird or Sparrow, it's not going to make anyone interested. When you say Lady Bird, people go, oh, I think I know what that is. And even though they're wrong, it kind of pricks up their ears. So I think it's a great move. And again, when you see the movie in context, the nickname Lady Bird makes sense. This film stars Saoirse Ronan, who is an Irish actress who has been phenomenal since she was a little kid.
I loved her work in a movie called Brooklyn. Was that a year ago, 2 years
ago?
Absolutely.
It was 2 years ago. She was nominated for Best Actress for that. She also was nominated for Supporting Actress for her role when she was 13 in Atonement, which is a phenomenal film.
And I think she's hosting Saturday Night Live tomorrow.
She is. She's hosting Saturday Night Live tomorrow, and my interview with her will be aired earlier. I talked to Saoirse Ronan, and she'll be on the Max and Movie Show tomorrow night.
Tomorrow night at 10 o'clock.
Absolutely, yeah.
Incidentally, she's Irish, and they got an obscure Irish band as a musical guest for tomorrow night.
That's right. You as well, I think, is the name of the band.
No, You Too.
Oh, that's right, You Too. That's right. I always get that confused.
T-O-O.
So Saoirse Ronan has been phenomenal in everything she's been in, whether it's an adaptation of a popular book like Lovely Bones or an original piece like Hannah. She is just a phenomenal actress, wonderfully talented, and it says something that she can be in a film like Brooklyn, a period piece, and feel of that time, mm-hmm. or be in a movie like Lady Bird, which is set in 2002, and feel of that time, listening to Justin Timberlake and Dave Matthews. She plays an American here, and if you didn't tell me she was Irish, if I didn't know that, I wouldn't know. And it is set in 2002, and 9/11 is brought up a couple of times. This is a coming-of-age movie of a high school senior who wants to go to certain colleges. She hates living in Sacramento. It's basically teenage angst, the movie. But what sets this movie apart from every other coming-of-age teenage angst movie is that this was written and directed by a woman. And I think that is such an important aspect of this film. This is a story that would not be told by a man, especially not like this. If you look at any other coming-of-age movie like Breakfast Club, anything that John Hughes did, obviously it's from a male point of view. Even Perks of Being a Wallflower, which I love, is from a male point of view. And with this one, I felt like I was being brought in on a secret, basically. Like, oh, this is what being a high school senior was like being a woman. Although, it's also highly relatable because we're all human beings. We all went through that same thing. This is also a mother-daughter relationship story, and how many father-son stories have we had that are celebrated over the years? We don't have a lot of mother-daughter relationship movies, and this one, her mother is played by Laurie Metcalf, who will be nominated for and has a great chance of winning Best Supporting Actress at the Academy Awards. For any critic out there who's surprised at how good she is in this movie, you never watched her on Roseanne, because she was phenomenal week in and week out. Their relationship is, I think, very, very believable, where they're at each other's throats 1 minute, and then in the very same scene, something wonderful happens, and they're lovey-dovey. That was my sisters and my mom.
Let me just add something about Laurie Metcalf. She also plays Sheldon's mother on The Big Bang Theory, and even in its later seasons, as the show has gone downhill and become very repetitive, she, whenever she shows up, adds a spark to the set that you can see, and her performance is head and shoulders above everybody else. Also, she was famed for an episode of Louis C.K.'s show, Horace and Pete, in which she did a monologue that, if it wasn't 15 minutes long, I'd be surprised, and was stunning forget about the Louis C.K. involvement in that and just look at Laurie Metcalf's performance in that role. And she's been a Broadway star for the last decade or so. This woman works a lot.
Well, this feels like the culmination of her career. I mean, I really think she has a great chance of winning, and she should, because she's always been phenomenal, whether it's on stage, on TV, or in the movies. This movie was, it did not surprise me that it won Best Picture and Best Actress and Best Director at the New York Film Critics just a couple of days ago. I do think that this will do very well Oscar season, and it should, because along with some other movies that I could bring up right now, like Big Sick and Blade Runner, this is one of the best films I've seen all year. You were saying earlier you wanted to take your wife to it, but you didn't want to feel forced to take your wife to it, and I get what you're saying. You know, this could be classified as a female film or a chick flick, but that's not the case. This isn't like a romantic comedy like Home Again with Reese Witherspoon. This is a movie featuring authentic human beings. I felt like when the movie was over, these people still existed and they were still living their life.
Good. I don't have a problem going to see movies with great female characters in them. I just don't want it to be sugary and syrupy.
Absolutely. And this is neither sugary nor syrupy. These feel like well-rounded, actual human beings that you could reach out and touch. It's such a authenticity in film is so difficult to attain, and I think that's what Greta Gerwig has done with this movie. And you know, we had the controversy of Oscars So White a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be surprised if we get into something in a post Weinstein world of Oscars So Women, and they decide to shower praise, deserved praise, but to make a big deal that okay, Greta Gerwig, female director, Patty Jenkins, female director, mm-hmm. Catherine Bigelow, female director. Mm-hmm. I think that could be what we're going to see come Oscar time.
I would not be surprised. Okay, so Lady Bird is the name of the movie, and on a scale of 10?
I give Lady Bird a 10.
Wow.
Absolutely. It's one of the best films of the year.
Better than The Big Sick. Better than Get Out.
It's right now on my personal list, which I'm putting together for end of the year. It is neck and neck with Get Out, which I think is a very important film. It's better than Big Sick.
Wow, that says a lot. All right, we got to take a break. We'll come back with more. I've got another movie to talk to you about, and I've also got to talk to you about a documentary that's on Netflix now and a little interesting story about the fallout of the Harvey Weinstein saga. All that ahead here on the Big 550 KTRS. It's the Big 550 KTRS. I am Paul Harris. Max Boise's here with me in the studio. Tim's keeping an eye on the roads. We're glad you're listening as well. And we're talking about movies as we do in this segment of the show every Friday afternoon. Next hour, of course, it'll be the Harris Challenge and Knuckleheads in the News. The fourth movie that we want to talk about today is called Last Flag Flying. This is a movie that opened last weekend, but we didn't get a chance to talk about because it was Thanksgiving weekend. And it's only playing at Plaza Frontenac. And really hasn't gotten much attention around the country. I think that's because some of these other movies that are out are kind of beating it to the critics' eyes and ears. And there are a lot of people who are just waiting for the Star Wars movie to open up in, what, 2 weeks?
Yes, two weeks.
Plus we've had the Thor movie and Justice League taking up so many screens across America for the last 3 weeks that it's hard for a movie like this to break through, which is odd because you've got a movie that stars Steve Carell and Bryan Cranston and Lawrence Fishburne. Those are three names that usually would get you some screens, but in this case, not so much. But let me tell you about the movie. It takes place in 2003, and that's when we meet Bryan Cranston, who is the owner of a rundown bar in Norfolk, Virginia. And Steve Carell shows up in the bar. Turns out he's an old friend of Cranston's from the Vietnam War, and he has a sad request. Carell's character had lost his wife to cancer earlier in the year, and now he's been devastated to learn that his son has been killed in action in Iraq. And even though they haven't seen each other in a long time, Carell wants Cranston and another former Marine buddy, Lawrence Fishburne, to provide moral support while he buries his son. Now, these three guys couldn't be more different. Cranston is a loud anti-authoritarian. Fishburne, he used to be a rowdy guy but gave up his wild past to become a minister. And Carell, who gives a beautifully subtle performance and really has become one of our best actors for comedy and drama. It's amazing to think that this is the same guy who was doing that goofy stuff in The 40-Year-Old Virgin. It's come a long way. In this movie, his character is a quiet man who's just been beaten down by life. As the plot unrolls, we also discover that something happened during their stint in Vietnam that ended with Carell doing some time in the brig while the others didn't. Still, they have a bond across the decades, and Carell needs that closeness of his former war buddies to help him get through this low point. So their adventure takes them to Dover Air Force Base, where they retrieve Carell's son's casket, and then they go on a road trip, effectively, to have him buried in his hometown in New England. First, they fight with the military, which wants him buried at Arlington National Cemetery. Carell wants him buried in his hometown. So along the way, they are assigned a young Marine who served with Carell's son to be the casket's official escort. And now you've got not just three veterans, but four veterans from different wars who have different stories, and they share them. And this may remind you a little bit of another soldiers on the road story called The Last Detail, which if you haven't seen from 1973, you should. Have you ever seen that movie, Max?
No, but I'm quite familiar with the cover art because I would always see it in the video store. And it was Nicholson, of course, with the sailor's cap and a big cigar.
Yes.
I think it's Bob Raffleson, I believe.
He directed it. You're right. You should go put that on your list. The Last Detail. Came out in 1973. It does have Jack Nicholson and a very young Randy Quaid and a guy who's kind of been forgotten by Hollywood named Otis Young. Both The Last Detail and Last Flag Flying were based on books by Daryl Ponickson, who co-wrote the screenplay for this with the director, Richard Linklater, who's a damn good director who knows when to slow the action down and allow us to simply listen to his characters.
Wait a minute. Richard Linklater directed Last Flag Flying?
Yes.
Why isn't this a huge awards contention
movie?
I know. I mean, Boyhood won Best Picture.
I know.
Doesn't make any sense.
This is the guy who made Before Sunrise, Before
yes.
Sunset,
and
Before
School
Midnight.
Of Rock,
and
he's done, yeah.
Yes, I know. That's what I'm talking about when I say here's a movie that
well, now I gotta see this movie.
It deserves to be on more screens than just one. And by the way, the listening part is particularly true in a scene where the three veterans go to visit Cicely Tyson as the mother of a man who may have died because of them when they were in Vietnam. Again, I'm not giving anything away here. I'm just telling you some plot points that come up along here. I'm not spoiling anything. The good news is, in this movie, we don't get burdened with flashbacks to the Vietnam War or to the Iraq War. Linklater is a better director than that. He purposely leaves these veterans' problems from the past somewhat vague. We don't need to know them to understand who these men are and what they've been through and what they are going through. Now, I will say that Bryan Cranston, who in the last few years, especially in movies like Why Him with James Franco, has proven he can chew the scenery as well as anybody. And he does go a little bit over the top in some scenes in this movie. But other than that, the performances are all very good. These friends bond all over again. The story sways from tragedy to dark comedy. Fishburne plays his character with stoicism, although he lightens up as the escapade unrolls. But I want to go back to Steve Carell for just a minute, because playing this quiet, grieving man, he really impressed me with his range. And this is not the kind of movie you get nominated for an Oscar for. And I'm not saying that if there were five Best Actor nominees, Steve Carell should be in it because of this one. But I'm telling you, he's damn good. He's damn good in this movie. It has its flaws, but I recommend Last Flag Flying a lot. I give it a 7.5 out of 10.
Nice.
Now, that's our movie review segment for the day, but there's other movie stuff to talk about. And I want to talk about this story about Wind River, which is a movie we reviewed, what, 4 or 5 months ago on the show?
Wind River?
Yes.
Yep.
It's a movie by a director named Taylor Sheridan, which unfortunately has been saddled with the Harvey Weinstein banner, because Weinstein's company produced the movie. But Taylor Sheridan, who got a lot of acclaim for the movie, which stars Jeremy Renner and Elizabeth Olsen as investigators probing the suspicious death of a young Native American woman on the reservation, Taylor Sheridan has bought the rights to his own movie away from the Weinsteins and erased Harvey Weinstein's name, not only from the movie, but from all For Your Consideration posters and
wow.
other documentation, because he wants the Academy to look at this without that taint of Harvey Weinstein's name.
And, you know, it not only is a wonderful gesture, but it makes sense, too, because nobody wants to give the Weinstein Company any awards.
And Taylor Sheridan says, I can't have a film about violence against women silenced by the perpetrator of that very act.
Right.
So I called the financier, I called the producer, I called Jeremy Renner, I called Lizzie Olsen, and I said, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to take it back. Now, the Wind River Awards campaign is being financed by the Tunica Biloxi tribe from down in Mississippi.
Wow.
they recognize the importance of it to their own community. They are mailing out Oscar screeners without Harvey Weinstein's name on it. And future income from this film, Taylor Sheridan said, is going to go to the National Indigenous Women's Resource Center.
Phenomenal.
How about taking something horrible and turning it into something really, really good? And by the way, the movie is really good as well. I think I gave it a 7.5 or 8.
Sounds right.
When I reviewed it a few months ago. So go see that. Now, what do you know about Roman J. Israel, Esquire?
I don't know much. I know that it stars Denzel Washington.
He plays a lawyer, obviously. That's what the Esquire means.
It's not getting very good notices.
This is a movie. I saw him on Jimmy Fallon's show last week, which was frustrating. And we're going to talk about this in just a second. Very frustrating to see him on that show because they did a short interview, showed a quick clip from the movie, then they went to a commercial break. And when they came back, they were shooting hoops with everything but basketballs.
That's because Jimmy Fallon can't do any kind of interview.
Correct. He wants to just play fun and games, which is why he slipped a second in the ratings, by the way.
Looks like Roman J. Israel, Esquire is set in the underbelly of the overburdened Los Angeles criminal court system. Denzel Washington stars as a driven, idealistic defense attorney whose life is upended when his mentor dies. It also stars Carmen Ejogo and Colin Farrell. Directed by Dan Gilroy of the Bourne Identity.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
But it's made about $4. It is not doing well. For a Denzel Washington movie.
Yeah, the last thing that Gilroy directed was Nightcrawler from 2004 with Jake Gyllenhaal, which is phenomenal.
Didn't Gilroy write that?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I like that movie a lot.
Great, great movie.
This is disappointing. I don't think we had a press screening for it.
I don't believe, no. Now, the former title of this film was Inner City, and they changed it to Roman J. Israel, Esquire.
Terrible name.
That's what I'm thinking. Even Inner City is kind of a more, oh, what's that about?
Yeah.
That's a bad name.
The only thing I know about it is that he's a lawyer, and he's got an afro. It looks a little bit like Questlove from Fallon's show.
Sure.
Last thing I want to talk about here today is a documentary that's on Netflix now called Jim and Andy. The Jim is Jim Carrey. The Andy is Andy Kaufman, who Jim Carrey played in a movie about 20 years ago called Man on the Moon, which was a pretty good movie about an incredibly annoying guy. Were you ever an Andy Kaufman fan?
I can admit that I've never understood Andy Kaufman. I do think the Mighty Mouse, Here I Come to Save the Day bit,
which he did on the very first Saturday Night Live.
I think that is wonderful. But, I mean, I never watched Taxi. I don't really know. I didn't get his whole wrestling thing, the Tony Clifton stuff. It really, and I know that people love the performance art aspect of it. It never made a connection with me. It did with Jim Carrey, obviously.
Yes. Andy Kaufman was a spoiled brat. People go, oh, he was a genius. No, he was a spoiled brat, and he was the emperor with no clothes. His only talent was being able to come up with ideas for how to do stupid things that annoyed
people,
yeah. But they wouldn't admit they were annoyed because they were told he's a genius. He actually did one thing. I remember this from Evening at the Improv, the TV show with the stand-up comedians.
Sure.
Andy Kaufman's set involved him sitting on the stage in a chair and telling people he had a cyst on the back of his neck, and if they wanted to, they could line up and come touch it. How is that funny? How is that comedy? It's not. But these idiots, like lemmings, stood up and went up there and touched it. He didn't do any material. He wasn't doing any shtick. That was it. This is a guy who used to bus tables at a deli in Hollywood. And people would come in there and go, are you Andy Kaufman? No, no, no. He would deny it. He would spill things on people on purpose. That's not performance art.
Now, I know
that's a mental health issue.
There's always been, I mean, any celebrity who dies, there's always the, he's still alive. You know, I mean, we've had it with everybody.
No,
but if there was anybody
I
could
don't
see
even start
doing
that.
It,
no.
No, I could see it being him.
No, no, no. He died of cancer. When he was on the Taxi set playing Lotka Gravis, which was born out of his foreign man bit that he used to do on stage, he was annoying to everyone around him. Judd Hirsch, Christopher Lloyd, Danny DeVito, etc. And yet they all agreed to be in Man on the Moon, essentially playing themselves, although Danny DeVito played his manager, George Shapiro, who, by the way, is the nephew of Carl Reiner. I like to drop in Carl's name whenever I can.
Sure, yeah.
And Jim Carrey, when he was playing Andy Kaufman in Man on the Moon, took on the Andy Kaufman persona so much that he never let anybody refer to him as Jim. He acted like Andy Kaufman all the time, except when he was playing Andy Kaufman's stupid lounge lizard alter ego, Tony Clifton, in which case he was even more obnoxious and refused to admit that, A, it was actually Jim Carrey inside there, or that he was actually doing an Andy Kaufman character. He would not let people call him Jim, ever. And yet he would insult people, and the documentary shows that people fell for the same garbage that they had fallen for from Andy Kaufman, now with Jim Carrey. As Tony Clifton, he comes into the makeup room to get made up, and he brings in a boombox, and he's playing it so loud that Judd Hirsch and Danny DeVito have to put their hands over their ears, and the women who were in there, they're fearful for their jobs. And yet, everybody go along, because it's Jim Carrey, and after all, he's playing Andy Kaufman, and he's really into the role.
I feel like this documentary made you very upset.
It made me very, very upset. I actually had an argument on this show with Bill Zemme, who's a terrific writer, terrific biographer. He wrote books about Regis Philbin and Johnny Carson and many, many other people. And he wrote one about Andy Kaufman. And for a half hour, I argued with Bill Zemme about this, because Bill, unfortunately, falls into these Andy was a genius thing.
Sure.
And now here's Jim Carrey with this footage from back then, which was shot, by the way, by Lynn Margulies, who was Andy Kaufman's girlfriend, and Andy Kaufman's writing partner, Bob Zemuda, was in there all the time as well. It's all part of like an elaborate Andy Kaufman-like prank that everybody's involved in. But why would you want to be around somebody who is purposely being as obnoxious as possible all the time? All the time. And that's what this documentary is about. Don't even bother watching it. I've just told you what it is and how annoying it is. I will admit that when I first saw there was a documentary about Jim and Andy, I thought it was about the radio team that I replaced in the midday show here on KTRS in 1999. But it's Andy with an L-Y, not two E's. That was the difference. There was a married couple named with that name,
huh,
who were on here for about 15 minutes.
On this frequency?
On this radio station, doing middays.
Well.
Before me.
Huh.
All right, I know I got myself a little bit too worked up there. I'll tell you what.
Your face is all red.
Yeah, because just...
It'll be okay, Paul.
Because I'm the only one who knows that the Emperor has no clothes when it comes to Andy Kaufman. So now I'll calm down, take a break. Tim will check the roads. We'll do the news at the top of the hour, and then I'll come back here in fine form for the Harris Challenge. Plus, knuckleheads in the news, all ahead on the Big 550 KTRS.